Right now, most churches are planning their budgets for 2009. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the sponsors page at issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
Any of us look back and say interracial marriage should still be illegal on the day after Barack Obama is elected president of the United States?
If Barack Obama's parents were same-sex married, Barack Obama would have never been born.
Wouldn't it be cool if we could get 20,000 people having sex for seven straight days?
What we're saying is we're willing to accept some infanticide as the implication of our support for abortion.
Faith has sustained me through the challenges and the joys of my presidency, and faith will guide me for the rest of my days.
Does it feel like 3 weeks or more or less? All I know is the time is quickly winding down. January 20th, I believe, we'll have a new president of the United States, and 3 weeks after the election, we're going to do a little post-election analysis. We have covered this from the Democratic perspective here on Issues Etc. Mark Strickerich was with us some time back. The political perspective, we had Congressman John Shimkus in to talk about the election. The pro-life perspective, Scott Glusendorf gave us his thoughts on it. The social and cultural perspective, Dr. Albert Mohler and Colleen Carroll Campbell have talked about the presidential elections and the other elections that took place recently. First half hour of Issues Etc. today, this Tuesday, November the 25th. Some election analysis from a conservative perspective. Mark Hemingway will be our guest. A little bit later in the program, we'll be talking about Christians and the economic crisis. Security in churches. Do you need security guards, metal detectors, perhaps armed guards in church? Open lines in the second hour of the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You can join us for the next 2 hours. Our toll-free number, 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. And our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Mark Hemingway is a regular guest. He's staff reporter for National Review. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I understand you guys are moving. How's it going?
It's going well. A bit hectic, but things are coming along.
You're moving from one place in D.C. to another place in D.C.?
Correct. Actually, we're just moving about, 12, 15 blocks from where we currently reside. But we're in a one-bedroom apartment right now with one child, and we're expecting another. So we're moving into a three-bedroom house.
Well, Godspeed on the move. When is the next due?
The next child is due sometime in May.
Maybe it'll strike my birthday, the 20th. Aim for that one.
Actually, that's pretty close to the due date.
I tell Molly to aim for the 20th of May, and the new addition to the Hemingway family will share birthday with Wilkin for whatever that's worth.
Okay, she'll get right on that.
Was this a across the board drumming for the Republican Party in this last election?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, it was obviously, in electoral terms, it was an across-the-board drubbing. But the fact of the matter is that, while the Republicans lost the presidency and while they, sustained further losses in for the second consecutive election in Congress, the fact of the matter is that polling and other things, still show this to be pretty much a center-right country. There's no real evidence to suggest that people were voting for anything other than a change in leadership, not necessarily because they genuinely had a change of heart and were moving to the left about believing in more liberal policies.
John McCain referred to himself many times as a foot soldier in the Reagan Revolution. Is the Reagan Revolution over?
Well, no, the Reagan Revolution is certainly not over. I mean, part of the problem here is that the Republicans are a victim of catastrophic success. I mean, the Democrats have so accepted basic aspects of things that Reagan fought for that it's now become part of their policy worldview. I mean, things like welfare reform, which was initially, you know, something tossed around in the Reagan administration, lower taxes, all of these things are free trade. All of these things are issues that were really hotly debated, subjects during the Reagan era. And Democrats, opposed the welfare reform. They opposed free trade, and they opposed, much lower taxes. And yet, here we are, a situation where the Democratic guy running for president, was offering, major tax cuts to the middle class. Even if he, which is, a pretty remarkable thing for a Democrat, historically, even if, he was still talking about raising taxes some on the higher tax brackets, free trade is generally seen as a good thing by the Obama administration. And, there was certainly evidence that he supported that, vociferously. There was for all the talk about, keeping manufacturing jobs in the U.S. and things like that. There was that incident where Obama supposedly tried to assure our neighbors to the north in Canada that, he wasn't going to undermine free trade with them, even when he was making statements publicly that made it sound like he wasn't as hardcore a free trader as Republicans have been. There's a number of instances there where Democrats are succeeding largely because they have imbibed certain policy realities that they refused to give up for decades, but now they just accept as fact, which is that, extremely high tax rates impede economic growth and trade is good for the country, welfare reform is good, et cetera.
In the perspective of recent electoral history, was this really a major defeat for the GOP?
I mean, look, I don't think so at all. I mean, it was still, 47-53 or something like that? I mean, in terms of electoral terms, it was certainly a landslide, but this was not, Nixon in 1972 or Reagan in 1984. I mean, those were genuine landslides in terms of presidential elections. You still have a nearly 1 in 2 Americans that voted against Barack Obama in this country, and I don't think that's I think that's largely because those people subscribe to a more conservative worldview than Barack Obama has certainly evidenced.
Some Republican pundits, like Kathleen Parker, suggest that it's probably time for the GOP to push the social conservatives to the back of the bus. What do you think?
I think that is ludicrous, and I think that Kathleen Parker, in particular, is grinding a personal axe on that. It's very strange to me to see the people that have been the backbone of the Republican Party, somehow be scapegoated by, certain people in the journalistic journalistic establishment among the more elite Washington establishment of the GOP. The bottom line is that social conservatives are not these, backwards yahoos that they're constantly portrayed to be. They're not anti-science. They're not, they're not blind to realities. They are people that, simply, cling to certain moral absolutes. And the bottom line is that there are certain things that social conservatives hold dear that the Republican Party better pay attention to. I mean, say the moment the Republican Party no longer becomes the pro-life party, I mean, they no longer have a chance of being a majority party. Because a lot of those issues that people attach to social conservatives cut across a much wider swath of society, like in pro-life terms, it's Catholics and a lot of other, major voting groups, than people realize. And so I think scapegoating them would be a big mistake for the GOP. That said, I do think they need to, repackage their policies and look at things in different ways. There's a very good piece in the latest issue of National Review by Rehan Salam, who's a co-author of a new book with Ross Douthat, an editor at the Atlantic Monthly, called Grand New Party. Well, anyway, in this article in National Review, Rehan talks about, how the GOP has done things like they focus on, they need to repackage their economic issues, so that it appeals to a broader spectrum of people. For instance, the Republicans are obsessing over low tax rates, but the fact of the matter is that, the average you know, family can see as much amount of their income go away in healthcare premiums these days as they are paying in federal taxes. So, you know, you have to pay more attention to, you know, at least as much attention to the healthcare issue as you do taxes. And, you know, I don't think there's any, you know, dispute that Republicans historically have been terrible talking about certain aspects of domestic policy, among them, you know, healthcare. And John McCain was living proof of that in the last campaign.
With only about 30 seconds, you mentioned the GOP scapegoating. Was Sarah Palin the victim of that, or was, in retrospect, was she just kind of a poor choice for John McCain?
I don't think she was a poor choice. I think that her rollout was mishandled badly, and I think that, you know, you can make a case that on certain issues she was, you know, seen as out of her depth. But that's not something that couldn't have been rectified. I think what we saw is we saw a lot of people who were employees in the McCain campaign badly mishandle the rollout, and then they tried to scapegoat Palin, you know, so that they can continue to get jobs in the town for screwing up, you know, they screwed up the rollout of one of the most promising political figures in recent political history. And so, you know, they are trying to, you know, find a way for anyone to blame her as opposed to them not doing their jobs. But, you know, look, the bottom line is that, you know, you have to look at the flip side of Sarah Palin here. Joseph Biden, you know, the vice president-elect, has been in Washington for 36 years and has distinguished himself by holding the exact wrong position at the exact wrong time for 36 years. You know, he is a guy that, you know, is constantly embarrassing himself every time he opens his mouth. And, you know, to sit here and condemn Sarah Palin as being this Yahoo outsider who doesn't know a thing about Washington when Joe Biden represents the absolute worst of, you know, what it means to be a long-term, crusty, you know, Washington insider is being rather short-sighted. Palin had some weaknesses, but she also had some real strengths being an outsider, and to completely scapegoat her, I think maybe a bit fair. That said, I'm not real keen on, you know, everyone deciding to line up behind her right now. I think that should be determined later.
Mark Hemingway is our guest. Political pundits listening to us, here's your chance to talk to a Washington pundit, Mark Hemingway of National Review. The election was 3 weeks ago today. Give us your analysis on the election. Call or email during this break, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, or talk back at issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon. It's November the 25th. Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor John Pless, on Treasury of Daily Prayer.
No doubt that it will become a devotional classic, the likes of which American Lutheranism has not seen. It is a literary testimony to the spiritual vitality of confessional Orthodox Lutheranism.
A Christ-centered, cross-focused family devotional, Treasury of Daily Prayer, 1-800-325-3040, or find out more at our website, issuesetc.org.
618-223-8384. It's the new phone number for the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8384. Leery about calling a live radio talk show? Want to remain anonymous? Leave your recorded question or comment on the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. The good, the bad, the ugly. We're big boys. We can take it. 618-223-8384.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Would you like to post your favorite Issues Etc. audio segments on your website or blog? Well, we've made it easy for you. Just go to the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the embed green logo, and copy and paste the embed code on your website or blog. It's just like posting a YouTube video. Embed Issues Etc. audio on your website or blog today. We love our on-demand listeners. Old theology, new technology. Issuesetc.org.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. Robert Meyer, Mariah Buto, Barbara Smith, Jim Lee Jr., Annette Rice, Greg Cook, Neil Trenery, Joshua Henson, and Christina Henson. Thanks for your support. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., Adoption in the Scriptures, Pastor Eric Rotman will be our guest. Doing a little election analysis with Mark Hemingway, staff reporter for National Review. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. You can join us as well. Your chance to talk to a Washington pundit. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesztc.org. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. Okay, Mark, let's see. What does Barack Obama have to do first day? What does he have to do first day after the inauguration?
All right. Well, first day, that's a difficult question. But I just say that he has a couple of big priorities here. One is, you know, he needs to clearly communicate with the American people and financial markets in particular what he is doing to save the economy. There needs to be, you know, no confusion about that, and he needs to have a cohesive, you know, ideologically consistent plan that people can sort of, you know, they will know what, you know, even if things get worse, they will know what the future holds for them. They will know what the government is going to do you know, restore confidence in markets and to, you know, help stimulate the economy. Now, there's a lot of opportunity to screw that up, and, you know, I could talk for days about what he should or shouldn't do specifically to help markets, but I think the priority there needs to be, you know, clarity of communication. You know, free markets can solve a lot of problems on their own, but they can't solve informational problems if there's not, you know, clear information out there in the markets. And that's been a real problem thus far. I mean, people are trying to conceal various things on balance sheets, particularly in the subprime crisis. And that was a big problem during the New Deal, in fact. You know, people always credit, you know, FDR for things for the New Deal somehow salvaging America. Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is the New Deal is a failure in a lot of ways. One of the major reasons why it was a failure is because it was just a completely scattershot, you know, series of policies and ideas. And that inconsistency, you know, no one knew what the government was going to do next, led to a lot of problems. And Barack Obama, if he's going to have a successful economic plan, needs to be entirely clear and consistent in whatever it is he chooses to do.
Okay, one of the criticisms that I've heard from both sides of the transition is that President Obama seems to be drawing from an awful lot of former, and even in those days, former highly ranked Bill Clinton people. But does he have anybody else to choose from? Him, after all, if he went back to other people who'd worked in Washington in that capacity, go all the way back to the Carter administration.
Yeah, no, I mean, you raise a good point there. And who does he have to choose from? I mean, the fact of the matter is he's choosing the elite of the Democratic establishment. And obviously, you know, with the Clinton administration only being, you know, 8 years, you know, prior, a lot of these people are still floating around Washington. A lot of them, you know, are competent, more or less. And, you know, actually, if you're a Republican, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, after Clinton came in there with a bunch of liberal good intentions, and he took a drubbing in the 94 congressional election. He governed pretty much as a center-right president in most key ways. And so I think that should be a relief to, you know, conservatives and Republicans that he's choosing people from the, you know, Clinton establishment and such. So, yeah, that should work out all right, I think.
What's been the reaction from the liberal blogosphere to President-elect Obama's cabinet picks? They were really calling for big change, real change.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of hand-wringing over Obama's selections here because they are sort of conventional, you know, centrist selections, you know, and people were looking for, you know, him to take some wildly progressive tack. Because they think some, you know, people on the left think that somehow the center-right path that this country has been on for the last several decades isn't, you know, serving us well. You know, I think they're wrong about that. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, telling that, you know, Obama himself, after promising all this change, is already backtracking on promises that he said he'd do during the campaign. He said that he's going to wait 2 years to let the Bush tax cuts expire rather than repeal them immediately, which is something he had promised in the campaign. So, you know, as far as being the candidate to change, it looks like the more things change, the more they stay the same. But, you know, given the uncertainty of what's going on right now, I mean, I have to say that might be prudent of Barack Obama. Sometimes, you know, the best thing that the government can do is to do nothing. And I'm not sure in a climate of uncertainty, you know, you want to go in there and start shaking things up. You know, you want to sort of feel your way through this. And Obama is, I think, prudent to do that.
What does the GOP need to do as the loyal opposition? What does it need to do to start regaining some margin in the legislature and perhaps regaining the White House? What's its biggest to-do item?
Well, I think it needs to reestablish its credibility on a number of issues. For the longest time, you know, the GOP was the party of fiscal conservatism, and they've historically claimed the mantle of that. But George W. Bush was a prolific spender and a terrible president in that regard, and he dragged Congress along with him, and he ceded to a lot of Democratic spending demands and other things, and just generally his whole compassionate conservatism worldview, you know, was perfectly in line with, say, in enacting new entitlements such as the prescription drug benefit, which was, you know, basically a big electoral ploy to win the 2004 election. So, you know, given the climate that we're in, if the Republicans could establish themselves as the party of fiscal conservatism again, and they could, you know, hold people's feet, and especially the Democratic congressional leadership's feet to the fire on this bailout, then they might start to establish some credibility with voters. I mean, I think there's already a lot of regrets over what's going on with this bailout, and the Republicans, at least congressional Republicans, were a lot of them were smart to oppose it, I think. I mean, I don't think people quite realize what's going on here. I was reading a thing today where if you do an inflation-adjusted dollars, the amount of commitments the federal government has made in terms of the current bailout amounts to more money than the Marshall Plan, the Louisiana Purchase, the savings and loan crisis, the Korean War, the New Deal, the invasion of Iraq, the Vietnam War, and NASA's lifetime budget combined. You know, we're on the hook for about $24,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. You know, we've already promised more in cash outlays than we spent on World War II. You know, this could be, this could really blow up in the Democrats' face if the economy doesn't get better real soon, with American taxpayers being on the hook for that much. So, you know, Republicans, if they want to get reelected again, you know, need to be ready to be standing there as the vanguard of fiscal conservatism and, you know, prudent, you know, spending in 2010 and then 2004.
Two quick final questions, Mark. Who is out there in the GOP who can emerge as a credible leader in the cast that you've just described?
Well, this is a really tough question. There's certainly a dearth of leadership, I think, in the GOP, or this, you know, promising up-and-coming leadership. The GOP has some very good people, like Mitch McConnell, who's just a fantastic minority leader and just the best legislator you could ever hope for. But the fact of the matter is, a guy like Mitch McConnell is not and will never be particularly charismatic or telegenic. And there's a lot of those types of figures in the Republican Party. That said, there are some of the younger congressional leadership, guys like Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, Eric Cantor, John Shattuck of Arizona. These are all very, very smart, you know, guys that are fully more than capable of stepping up if they're given a chance in the GOP congressional leadership. As for broader scale, I would urge everyone to be cautious about lining up behind Sarah Palin right now. I think she's got a lot to prove. That said, she's incredibly charismatic, and very bright, and a very, very quick study. So, you know, who knows? Given a few, you know, years to go over policy details and stuff, you know, she could come out there and knock them dead. And, you know, we haven't seen as much of them much of him on a national stage as we probably should yet before we anoint him the next leader. But Bobby Jindal is very young, the governor of Louisiana, and is a very, very smart guy. I mean, he is just first-rate intellect. He's, you know, being an Indian American and everything, he really is a fresh face to the GOP. And he's, you know, governing one of the most historically problematic and corrupt states in the union. And if he at all can make a persuasive case in, you know, 4 to 8 years that he turned that state around in significant ways, especially post-Katrina, he will definitely emerge as a real leader for the GOP. He just launched a big new healthcare reform initiative in Louisiana, and I would be watching that very closely. If that worked out well, then, you know, we could see Jindal sooner rather than later running for national office.
Then with only 15 seconds, Mark, your prediction on how the Senate races will end up in Minnesota and Georgia, and will the Republicans be able to keep at least the possibility of a filibuster alive?
Well, Minnesota is very it's almost too close to call, but with 78% of the vote counted, Coleman is still holding on the lead. So, I mean, I'd say you got to go with Coleman there for now. And as for Georgia, it looks like Sackett Chambliss is up by about 3%. And I would expect that to hold. I was kind of surprised that race was as close as it was. It was only because it was an insane Democratic year, and Obama dragged a lot of extra Democrats to the polls with him. I imagine Chambliss will pull that out, no trouble. But Minnesota's still too close to call.
Folks, you can read Mark Hemingway's columns at issuesetc.org. Click on demand. Mark Hemingway is a staff reporter for National Review. Joined us from Washington, D.C. Give our best to Molly and to Evangeline and to the one that's on the way, Mark.
Okay, well, we will do.
Mark Hemingway, when we come back from this break, you know, I'm looking at my computer screen here, and they're talking about firming up this stimulus package that's changed its uniform several times in the last couple of weeks. The economy is not good. That's an understatement. We're going to talk about Christians and economic crisis with Pastor Penn Ball on the other side. Stay tuned. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
On behalf of the staff of Issues, Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues, Etc. Debbie Derendinger, Pastor Stephen Gallo, Joanna Hensley, Joan Garvey, Charles Michaelis, Brian Keller, Roberta Schutten, Jeanette Warman, David Warman, and Fred Pullman. Thanks for your support.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
A survey of evangelical voters explains why a quarter of them voted for pro-abortion Barack Obama for president over pro-life John McCain. The so-called Obamagelicals have a different view about ending abortion. They don't think pro-life legislation is the answer. They couldn't be more wrong. An in-depth study by Dr. Michael New, a political science professor at the University of Alabama, tells why. Pro-life legislation has a dramatic impact on lowering the number of abortions. These laws include informed consent, waiting periods, and parental involvement laws. When the permission of both parents is required, the number of abortions drops by a third. For more details about this research, go to lifeissues.org and click on today's broadcast link.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come. Join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30. And find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois at trinitymillstadt.org.